Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Welcome to the Bradley Wiggins Show by Eurosport, bringing you a unique perspective on the biggest races and talking points throughout the 2019 pro cycling season. I'm Graham Wilgos, and we've got something of a classic feel to today's episode as we welcome 2004 Paris-Roubaix winner Magnus Bakstad to the studio. Maggie, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
The home of cycling, of course, is almost your second home nowadays. You're dropping in for a chat before your commentary appointment later.
Yeah, it's definitely becoming a regular feature in what I'm doing. So, yeah, nice to be here.
Oh, it's a pleasure to have you. And, of course, the main man, Brad. How are you?
Yes, good, thank you, yeah.
Yeah? Good week?
It's been all right. Up and down. But
up and down, a little bit of
it's
little
always
bit of sickness.
Good to finish it on the end of the week, watching the classic San Remo, historic race, and what a finish. I'm sure we'll get into that later.
We will come to that later, and much to talk about there. But Magnus, I just want to start with you and what you've been doing with yourself, because you're a busy man, obviously, in pro cycling retirement. You've got not only your own business interests, but you've got two very keen cyclists under your wing currently too.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's cycling related, everything that we do within the family. So both of my daughters are racing at quite a high level now, and obviously everything that we do is going around trying to get them to and from bike races, and sort of getting everything ready for the following weekend again. So it's busy, but really, really interesting, and nice to see that they've picked a sport that obviously both me and my wife enjoy doing as well.
And you've both got the burden of being the dad taxi nowadays. I should think.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just trying to hold it off. My lad wants to do it a lot. I mean, Magus will, you know, understand this. It's quite a difficult decision to take. You want to leave them to it and let them make their own mind up. And I think one, always conscious of just pushing them, and kind of, especially with their names, you know, with both of us being ex-professionals and that you want them to forge their own way. And obviously Magnus's girls are well on the way to doing that themselves under their own esteem. But it is a difficult one, because, you know, the last thing you want to do is hurt them or put them into something that they will get hurt just because of their name and they're unawares of it. So it is a tough one. But at the same time, you know, you want them to find out about this great sport that's brought you everything in your life.
Well, from one man in Magnus putting many of his resources into his little team, to another, and Sir Jim Radcliffe, it's official this week. Team Sky will become Team Ineos from the Tour de Yorkshire from the 1st of May. Brad, obviously we spoke about this at length last week, but now it's official. Mm. What do we think?
You have to think it's a brilliant thing for cycling. You know, one major backer go out Sky in terms of what they've done for cycling. And this one coming in, replacing, you know, Sky, which is obviously, everyone's talked about the money input that Sky have put into it, and this guy's now going to put more money in. I mean, hats off to him, but at the same time, it's not a lot of money to him when you consider he's the richest man in Britain. Whether it's good for overall in cycling, considering how hard it is now for teams to find sponsorship and find money. I did see a quote the other day which made me chuckle, and it was Brailsford could put his hand down a toilet and pull chocolate out, which I thought was hilarious.
from Jonathan
and he does
Waters.
Seem to land on his feet, but hats off to Jim for putting his money in. And it remains to be seen, you know, we did speak about last week, the guys, you know, Geraint's this world and everyone that will be wondering what they're going to do next year, the quality of riders they got there that would all have to find new teams, and whether they'll get the same salaries, the commitments they have outside of cycling financially, that's a win put to bed for those guys. But
and I think the ripple effect that would have caused further down the ranks as well, even down to continental team level, that would have had an effect on riders.
I mean, the strength and depth at Sky, all having to find new sponsors, all wanting as close to their current salaries as possible. This is the problem. I think it's no good to sweep it under the carpet. At the end of the day, the sport is a bit on its arse, really, at the moment, financially, in terms of what other teams have. So for all the Jim Radcliffe's and all the Team Skies with the money they have, it's amazing teams like Quickstep do so well with the money they have. But further down, it just diminishes right down to, you know, the teams, the Wanty Gouberts of this world and that. I mean, it's quite a contrast, really. So
here's another Jonathan Vaughters quote for you then. He's described Sky as having this impenetrable wall of money. Now, in terms of having that resource compared to the rest of the peloton, the question has to be, how do we start to even that up? And do we start to introduce things like, as have been talked about this week, salary caps?
I don't think the salary cap, I think if there's a salary cap for everyone, the teams will just find the best organised team will still be where all the main sort of the big riders will go anyway. And I think if you look, and certainly I've not been part of Team Sky, I've been on the outside, but looking at what they do and how they structure everything around the riders, they do that probably the best in the world at the moment. So with that, I think the riders of, you know, like Egan Bernal, Ivan Sosa, they're choosing that team because of what they do and how they do it. So yeah, capping the salary, I'm not sure it will work. At the same time, you know, there's a lot of riders and a lot of teams out there. If they had £40 million given to them, they wouldn't say, no thanks, I'll just have 20.
You're not going to leave it on the table, are you?
No, exactly. So from my point of view, if the money's there from, you know, then it has to be taken into the sport.
It's hard to sit here and not be hypocritical and say they should have salary caps, because when we were riders, you want to make as much as you can when you can, because it's such a short career. And it was, you know, I was talking to someone last week, you know, it's only 20 years ago, the likes of Bjarne Riis, that it was on €200,000 when he won the Tour in 96. And when you consider that now, what these guys are earning, even 10 years ago, the likes of Andy Schleck and that, they were only on €1 million. Now these guys are earning €4 million, you know, so it's you can't sort of sit here now and say we need to have a salary cap just to make it better. I mean, one of the things I will say for Dave is he's always said, I don't follow what the sport's doing now. I want to try and envisage how I want the sport to look in 10 years' time and try and do that now. Now, that's quite visionary, and other people won't think like that, which makes them obviously need the money to do that as well. So with their office blocks and buses and kitchens and every rider's own washing machine, all of that, it's so far advanced to what some teams are thinking, and French systems, baguette and a can of Coke at the finish, and you know, it's wrapped in tinfoil. And it's like there's two worlds. It's contrasting. You know, you can see it's spoiling the sport, or is Dave the one who's got the problem, or is everyone else needs to catch up with them? And it's a tough one at this stage, and the void's just getting bigger and bigger on a grand tour level. But what I will say is on the one-day stage, it's just as competitive, I think.
It is as competitive. I mean, if we're looking at the Koenig Quick Step, we've got Astana doing really, really well this year as well. I think the Koenig is probably where Team Sky are in stage racing, the Koenig Quickstep are in one-day races.
Yeah.
So we've got to have a look at that as well. Are you allowed to have that many one-day specialist riders in a team? And I don't think we can start controlling the racing from a money point of view. It's got to be done on the bike. And I personally feel that if you're behind and you're chasing, then you just got to chase harder and make it work for you to sort of come up with a strategy of beating those guys. And I think the victories will become that much sweeter when you do topple them finally.
You've got to plunge your hand into the toilet and do the same thing that Dave
Brailsford
does.
Yeah, hopefully you come out with chocolate as well.
Other teams, as we say, though, can still compete. Okay, it gets more and more difficult the longer a race is. You get to Grand Tour level and it becomes very, very difficult to be able to compete with Team Sky. But you're talking about one-day races there, Maggie. You've still got that wonderful unpredictability about it. That said, obviously, De Koenig have been cleaning up. And we saw again yesterday at Milan San Remo, Julian Alaphilippe crossing the line first in another thrilling finish.
I mean, he just can't stop winning at the moment, can he? He's on a roll. You know, when you see a rider like him getting onto that crest of that wave, it's like Peter Sagan was a couple of years back. You just got to take your hat off to him and the team for producing these rides that that they do.
We did talk about him last week, didn't we? It was the way he won this time as well.
Yeah.
He led it out and won it. I mean, Sagan was there, Kwiatkowski was there. I mean, it was phenomenal, really. And that just shows the level of confidence now. And I mean, I think when you're on that crest of a wave, that crest of confidence, you take opportunities. You think less, don't you? And I think that's kind of where he's at the moment. And It was phenomenal.
It was a spectacular finish. Here's how Rob Hatch saw it.
Just a few hundred metres away, as Alaphilippe's going to have to launch it now. The end of Milano Sanremo, the 110th edition. Alaphilippe is going first. They come up to the line. Alaphilippe still at the front. It's going to be him. Oh, he can't stop winning. Alaphilippe has it. It was lethargic coming into the final few hundred metres. But once Alaphilippe hit the front, you wondered if he'd gone too early. The answer was a resounding no. De Koenig Quickstep do it again.
It was Alaphilippe's seventh win of the season, the fifth big one-day race this season for de Koenig, who, as we said, are cleaning up. Alaphilippe, there doesn't seem to be a race at the moment that he can't win, whether he's competing for a sprint, whether it's a kind of a strange mix of the two yesterday after, as we were saying earlier, Maggie, the fastest climb of the Poggio in the race's history, we think.
Yeah.
If you're Alaphilippe at the moment, you must be going into every single race feeling like, I'm the man for this. There's no one who can beat me. So what I wanted to come to with this was, and Maggie, I think there's one very famous example from you. But Brad, let's start with you. You got to the point in your career, and 2012 obviously stands out. We know about that. Did you feel like going into each race you went into, I'm the man here and there's no one... If things go my way, there is no one who can touch me.
Yeah, I wouldn't say I was walking around thinking I'm the man, but I was just in a hot patch where you stop thinking about it.
Mm.
And I think that came from the fact that we weren't celebrating the races that we were winning because it was all about one other race.
It was the build.
So I went from Paris-Nice, Romandy, Dauphiné, and because it's always about something else that's part of a plan, you tend to celebrate less. I think Maggie, obviously his thing was Paris-Roubaix, and I can remember when people forget, we almost won Gent-Wevelgem midweek before Roubaix.
Yeah, I did, yeah.
And in those days, Wevelgem was the build-up to Roubaix. So Roubaix was always, you didn't really think about that, you just almost, the concentration was on, I felt good today, I felt good second time at the Kemmel and that, because it's always about Sunday.
Yeah.
And you almost forget you got second in Wevelgem that day.
Yeah.
Because you won on Sunday and everyone forgets.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? So it's kind of this, and that's what it's like with the Dauphiné. You win the Dauphiné, but it's like, oh great, we're on track for the Tour. Like we forget G almost won that, because I override memories that he won the Tour. You don't think about what you're doing at the time until you look back, because it's always part of a bigger plan, really. And the Cobble Classics are the same, really. You get into this hot patch, and it's always about the goal you're aiming for and you're hoping to achieve. Mm. And you almost forget about the build-up races were just as good, but you tend to forget about this because they're part of the stepping stone.
Maggie, Paris-Roubaix 2004, you woke up that day feeling like, hold on a second here.
I could feel there was something. The moment I sort of climbed on the bike, I felt that it was something was different. It was just something, the way the bike felt and the way even the chain kind of responded, if you will, when I rolled off the car park. And I knew I was going well.
Like you had.
It's
an
funny,
extra
like you said, Brad, that the Gent-Wevelgem, I finished second in that.
It was
one.
Terrible weather that day, wasn't it?
It was pretty bad. But I managed to, like, the sprint I did, I led out from 400 to go, and there was only Tom Boonen who managed to come past me, and I kind of knew then I was onto something special. I was going really well, and it was part of the plan, because I always had Tour of Flanders as my last training ride. You know, I wanted to be in the early morning break and get 250k into the race, just to empty the tank to get ready, because that was the way my body worked for the following Sunday then. But yeah, going into that one, it was probably one of the few times where I felt that I had a team behind me. I everything was there, everything was set up, the equipment was right, everything. We turned over every stone on the way to Roubaix to have a look at what was underneath it and make sure that we knew exactly how to ride over it. And that kind of gave me that confidence as well, that I knew I was ready for it.
We'll come back to Roubaix. I just want to pause on Milan-San Remo briefly. So in that mix at the end, we had obviously Alaphilippe, who crossed the line first. You had Peter Sagan, Wout van Aert, Matteo Trentin, who was setting a serious pace on the descent, Valverde in the World Champ stripes, and Michał Kwiatkowski. He obviously won it the year before last. Sky Rider, what is it with Sky and the one-day races, the major one-day races, and the classics in particular? Because they've got two. They've got Kwiatkowski's San Remo win, and they've got Wout Poels.
Yep.
So why is it that to this point, they still can't seem to crack the one-day races and the classics in particular?
I think that the attention to the detail that they're paying into to stage race, right, stage racing and Grand Tours especially, isn't quite going into to the one-day races and the Cobble Classics in the way that you need to. Like I said, you almost need to turn over every single stone on the way from Compiègne up to the Roubaix Velodrome to make sure you know what's underneath it and how you're going to ride that certain stone. And I don't think, certainly from watching from an outside, that there is enough focus being done on that one. I know every year that I went there with a view of trying to win the bike race, I'd been across there four or five times already, motor paced across there and so on, making sure I knew exactly what equipment was the fastest and all that sort of stuff. And I don't know whether it's time or whether the riders and staff and the whole team is not quite looking at it in that way. It's just part of another bunch of races that they kind of need to cover because they are part of the World Tour. It's part of what they do.
Brad, how do you say?
Well, I also think that it's one-day races, it's a lot less controllable. It's like trying to keep a box of frogs in a box, you know, jumping out. The minute a classic starts, it's just bang, bang, bang.
Yeah.
This isn't a week-long race where they know they're going to get a day where they're going to go over 3 one-hour climbs where you can stick your five guys on the front, sit at 450 watts and absolutely control the peloton. You know, this one is you hit a Poggio. Most people can get over a climb of 5 kilometres at 30, 35k an hour. You know, this is a completely different thing. You can't stick your 5, 6 big climbers on the front, on the Cipressa or on the Poggio. You will always get someone willing to attack because there's only 3K to the summit and I've got a crazy descent. And the minute they catch them back, someone else will go. It's just the one days everyone's got a chance of winning and everyone is in with a chance of winning and you can't control it to the degree you control it in a Grand Tour. If all the classics were together over a week, you might have more chance because people get fatigued, people get tired. People can empty themselves in a one-day race to the likes of Matt Heyman and these guys and produce these crazy training scores and things like that, you know. But trying to do it the day after, the minute you start up a climb or something, that's where Sky come into their own. And I think, thank God, because these are, you know, kind of, you know, these are the ones that really kind of excite people to watch on TV. And that's why they're the classics. That's why they're so good. And interesting, Alaphilippe was the main instigator of the Poggio yesterday that really had a go. The only thing that surprised me yesterday with the likes of Valverde and all these guys watching as they came into the last sort of 800 metres to go was that lull of 10, 12, 13 guys. And I just thought someone would have gone like Chmiel would have gone back in the day and no one went.
Everyone waited.
I don't know if that's because Sagan was there and they was just kind of all waiting for Peter, but no one tried their hand.
But that happened last year as well, very, very similar. There was no one really giving it that go. And I think Peter is a big factor in that game. But it's also thinking that if you're looking down at that list there's a number of riders out of those 13 guys who are capable of winning a sprint. But are they all feeling like they are actually have got the legs and have got the ability to win, you know, on that day? And why not, you know, do you need to commit to that flyer? Matteo Trentin did a half-hearted kind of attack as they came down off the Poggio, but it didn't look 100% committed to me. Yeah.
And when you've got to that point of the race, so they always say with San Remo, don't they, it's the easiest classic to finish, but the hardest one to win. Did that old adage prove right yesterday?
I think you're right.
Not if you're Alaphilippe. I mean, it's phenomenal, really. Yeah. I mean, he would have been the one that I'd have expected to make that move.
Yeah.
And he made it from the front and led it out and won. We think the last, it's not even 11, 12 months since the Tour. King of the Mountains in the Tour, two stages in the Tour. San Sebastian, you know, whatever else he won in between that, he won the other week, Strada Bianchi.
Tour of Britain.
Milan-San Remo, phenomenal. Yeah. Absolutely, you know. Plouay, did he win Plouay? I mean, it's just incredible mix of races as well, and you sort of, I wouldn't be putting past him Liège. I think he's got second in Flèche last year.
He won it last year, didn't he?
Yeah.
So from one sensational finish at San Remo to, I think we have to mention this just because it was so close, the dramatic conclusion to Treno Adriatico on Tuesday, and it all came down to a 10.5-kilometre time trial. Adam Yates in blue at that point. All he had to do was not lose too much time to Primoz Roglic.
25 seconds,
correct, because we had the count back on the screen. In the end, the difference was 0.31 seconds. Gutting for Adam Yates. Only a short time trial, 10.5Ks. But what do we think? We've seen his brother Simon. He seems to have got the knack over the closed season of being able to be comfortable in that time trial position. And we saw with his win at Paris-Nice that was the case. But we don't yet feel that way about Adam, do we?
This time trial is a very specific time trial. I mean, it's I think from what I understand, it's the same one they've had every year.
It's the same.
It's 5K out, 5K back.
Yeah.
Typical Italian, as we spoke about last week. Dogs running across, people crossing the road. It's a beach resort, so there's wind coming off one way. It could be a headwind out one way, headwind back. There's a couple of speed humps on it. Probably the worst type of time trial for Adam Yates, actually, to go at. He probably did well to just lose the time he did. Mm-hmm. It just wasn't enough to win the race overall. But Maggie's ridden it many times, isn't it? It is a very specific
I care to remember, but
and it was normally the big build up to the classics where you'd say Fabian's in form because it was right up Fabian's street this time trial.
Yeah, and he still has the fastest time around there, just over 11 minutes, I think. But it is a very different time trial to the one that they had in Paris-Nice, where Simon obviously went and won. But looking at those two guys' time trial, I still think there's plenty of work to do with their positions to get them more comfortable, and get them faster on the bike. So I think some of the later sort of positions and developments that are happening around, not just in on the road sport side of the sport, but on the track especially, that there's plenty of scope to find a bit more speed for them on positions.
What's the deal there, Brad, in a time trial position? Like, you were obviously always super comfortable.
Yeah,
in
I mean,
that situation.
It's a tough one because for these guys, they're just bike racers, as we've said, you know, Adam and Simon. But they're losing bike races on time trials now to the likes of Dumoulin and G and these guys that are real. They're specialist time trials anyway, but they're able to climb with these guys. So they have to work on it. They're forced to work on it. And not everyone gets it right. So there's a contrast between going way too extreme in the tunnel to have super aerodynamic numbers, but just unrealistic in terms of holding that position when you get out in practice. So they've got a real balancing act to do. At the same time, they've still got to be concentrating on the things that made them good in the first place. Training, going out on the road, doing those rides, those steep climbs and that. So they've got, while all the other guys that have already nailed the time G and the like, just concentrating on working because they know that that's in the bag. So it's tough for them. You know, it really is. You know, they get better at time trialing and take their eye off the ball, then they're not as good climbing and what they were good at in the first place. So it's a balancing act, and you don't want to be spending years on it. And I think Simon has already looked like he's certainly made the difference in such a short time. Adam as well. Whether it's key to Adam or not in terms of winning long term, I don't know, really. I still think Simon's probably the one we're going to be looking at this year for the Giro and stuff, but it's not bad, is it? 13 seconds either way in that time trial to Roglic out and back. You know, it's I don't know what he would have lost a year ago, but they've made some advances.
You've got to think it's going to be a lot more. Ever lost a race by that sort of margin?
Time trial... No.
I lost time trial last stage in the Giro by 1 second to a Lithuanian guy once. It started raining on the cobbles at the end. And
how did you feel afterwards?
I was gutted.
But, of course you're going to be.
Yeah, I mean, you always tend to lose. I mean, there used to be a time trial in Dapana, 3 days. Dapana was always come down to seconds, you know, at the end of it and things. Prologues, you know, things like that. I still remember McGee won the Paris time trial. Miller's chain came off in the final and he won by, I think, 0.6 of a second to take the yellow jerseys for the only time in his career. You know, these things happen. It's like, that's why they're there.
That's bike racing. That's what makes the sport cool, isn't it?
He did pretty well on the podium afterwards to keep a smile on his face, because you've got to be thinking in that situation, haven't you? Like, just get me off.
Well, yes and no.
Back into the bus.
I don't know, really. It's whether, I always got to think in those situations, as disappointing they are at the time, if someone had said to him early in the year, you're going to finish second in Terreno Adriatico, but not tell him how, it's all very well hindsight, really.
Yeah.
And I've got to think where he's at now in terms of his build-up to what his real main goals are. Tirreno would not have been his main goal of the season. You know, this is about bigger things to come.
And it's keeping your eye on
that. It's almost like it's that first test, isn't it, of the season, really, to kind of work out where am I roughly, how's the body feeling.
And I tell you now, he's got the best man around him in Matt White to pull him back.
Yeah.
All right. Well, plenty more to come on the Bradley Wiggins Show right after this.
In 2019, cycling fans across Europe will be able to watch over 30 UCI World Tour events live on Eurosport and Eurosport Player, available on the app and online via eurosport.co.uk. Eurosport Player also allows viewers to catch up and relive all the action on demand. Eurosport will bring fans unrivaled expertise and analysis from all the best moments of the 2019 season.
Welcome back to the Bradley Wiggins Show by Eurosport. Chaps, the classic season is upon us. Gent-Wevelgem, the cobbles just around the corner. Magnus, let's start with you as our classics winner. 2004 Paris-Roubaix, as we've already mentioned.
Thank you.
I'm sure you can't talk about it enough.
15 years ago now. And I think it's the only title that I have that you haven't managed to get.
Riding the cobbles is a particular skill, and being able to do it and do it comfortably, because you being able to physically drill yourself over that sort of course over that many hours and then still put yourself in a position to win it, because it's about riding sometimes a great long time effectively on your own.
I kind of put it down to almost 27 individual pursuits in a day of 260 kilometres of bike racing. The numbers are not too dissimilar in terms of what you're doing across the cobblestones in power output. And yeah, like you said, it's a lot of it is individual time trials across the cobblestones. You want to make sure that you're as sheltered as you possibly can be, but at the same time, the moment you put yourself in a sheltered position, you also can't really see where you're going properly. You can't sort of avoid the bigger holes and the bigger obstacles that you find you come across. So it's always that fine balance between being too close to the wheels in front of you and being caught up in a crash or hitting through and breaking a wheel, puncturing whatever we throw at it, and saving as much energy as you can, and getting that sort of feel right and getting that right is really, really difficult to do.
And getting that feel right, as you say, how does it actually feel sort of being bounced across those cobbled sections?
Well, obviously you the first time you hit the cobblestones on any time you go out on them, you can't really see where you're going, because it's almost like your eyeballs are rattling in your head. But when you get onto it, and I think more when you're carrying enough speed across them, it actually feels smoother. So the faster you go, the smoother it feels. And every rider is different in terms of how they make that happen, whether you're riding high cadence or whether you're just turning a big gear across the cobbles. You know, everyone's got to find their own way of doing it right.
Brad, how did you feel about the cobbles? Did you dread them? Did you
no,
came around
I mean,
to the
I dreaded everyone around me, particularly towards the later years. I knew that I could do something in this race. I knew I had the legs to, because it's just a time trial, as Maggie said. It's about producing high numbers across the cobbles. I knew I had physically in me to get to the finish in the front. But my problem was everyone else. So there's so much emphasis in the meetings the day before, in the morning, about economy, save your energy to the later stages, save it. So this, you go out with this saving, eat, save. But before the first cobbles, it's just mayhem. And you've got to make these big accelerations, these big sprints up the sides, in, out. And and you're still thinking, save. No, it's 150K to go, just don't. And by doing that, by just not challenging yourself, you find yourself way too back and making efforts anyway. There's always a crash, yeah, first cobbles. Yeah. You'll always find yourself coming off the first section in the third group, looking up ahead, thinking, oh, God, and chasing and chasing and chasing. And at some point, you are going to have to commit and realise, OK, the race started. And that, for me, was always Arenberg. I always found,
yeah,
you come out of Arenberg in a good place, you stay in a good place, and you just that's it. That's the time to commit. No more saving anymore. And so
about 3Ks, 4Ks before Arenberg is where it really starts. And that, to me, that is the biggest lead out and the biggest commitment that you'll find any rider take, and the biggest sacrifice they're willing to make throughout their whole cycling careers,
yeah,
is the run into the forest of Arenberg. You just really couldn't care less at that point what happens. It's just you being top 2-3 onto the cobbles in the forest, or you in a pile on the floor, and it's going to be one or the other.
Now, you always found you made more sprints and more efforts. The start of Arenberg is your finish line.
Yeah.
And you hit the cobbles in a good place, and then you can ease off a bit.
Yeah.
Right, I've done it, I'm in the good place. And then you hear all the carnage behind. Now, if you're in that carnage behind, you can come out 3 minutes down out of the forest, and pretty much the race is over, unless you're lucky and there's a problem up front, or a big hitter up front punches, and you can come back through the cars with them. But it is like that, and it's a constant then. Now, for all the recons and finding out lefts and rights, and okay, I remember this bit, I always found after Arenberg, and particularly after the second feed, that all goes out the window, and you find yourself
in a tunnel.
Tarmac, hitting cobbles, off, up, tarmac, hitting cobbles, off, and before you know it, you're 40K to go, and you are where you are. So it's an amazing race. There's no other race like it. I mean, it really is. And my last Paris-Roubaix, I was in that frame of mind of save it, save it, save it. I watched all the carnage happening behind, and at some point I thought, this is ridiculous, Brad. And I managed to get to the front before Templer, and I just followed the motorbike and went for it. And I found myself from the back of the race, within 2K, I was off the front with Steve Bart and another guy, 1 minute up on the peloton, 40K to go, I'm in the front three in Paris-Roubaix. 5K before that was last man of the main group on the road. I mean, until you commit and just go for it, Roubaix can just change in a heartbeat for you.
It is never finished until you cross that last cobblestone, and sometimes even just behind that.
So your win, Magnus, in 2004... was Brad's, I think I'm right in saying this, your second Paris-Roubaix.
Yes. Yeah? Yeah.
And Johan Museo was in that final group with, yeah, you, making your way into that last 6K. The velodrome's almost in sight at this point. And Museo punctures. And that's well, he rolls in fifth in the end, we think.
Grouzon, yeah. He punched on Grouzon, did he?
On him. So, yeah, Johan was the one who sort of tore that race apart across the first part of the Carrefour. And I remember Baldato dropped me off on Johan's wheel just as we turned on to the Carrefour. And I was sitting there thinking, this is really hurting. a lot, and I didn't think we were actually going to be anything special like that. It was just, you know, it was really uncomfortable and painful, but it wasn't that bad. And as we turned out, you know, gone past a calf in carry four, turning out on that little, like 50 metres of tarmac road, and looked back and there was only five of us left, and at that point it was just full commitment to the velodrome. And I remember going across, coming into Hem, there's those tarmac sections on the side of the road and cobbles in the middle, and you kind of flick from left to right, and we flicked across from left to right just to take to get the apex on the corner, and I just missed a stone, and Johan was on my wheel and he hit it.
So one stone ends your race in that situation.
Yeah, and it's funny how that kind of goes around, because a couple of years earlier I was in the front group going in there for podium position, and I punctured 100 metres after that last section in Hem. So I thought that's a bit of swings and roundabouts going on there.
What goes around comes around. Talking of what goes around comes around, Johan was one of your great heroes, wasn't
yes,
he, when
he
you
was.
When you were growing up.
Yeah.
And there's, I think you've spoken about this before, where you went to the Tour of Flanders in 1993 to see him, and you want to get a picture with him afterwards, and so you're there with your mum.
96, yeah, 96.
Apologies.
Yeah, right.
And she gets a picture of you walking across the car park with him, because you've gone up to say hello, but you don't quite
He's pissed off. He's just snapped a spoke, that was the story, but I think it was with his legs on the Mur de Grammont.
Yeah.
While Bartoli is attacking. And Michele won, Museo comes back to the group, finishes third. Stays in the bus to the 11th hour until his car's ready, and has to walk across from the bus to his car. You know, just like, yeah. But that's what it's like, you know, that's why I'm here today.
Well, that's one of the reasons. But then, having not quite had that sort of teenage fanboy courage to go up and say hello to him, he, years later, has got a son who's a big fan of yours, and he turns up at Paris-Roubaix.
Just before Roubaix.
And he wants to say hello to you, and he's bought, not only has he bought a couple of his jerseys for you, and you've obviously, you know he's coming, so you've got a jersey for him. What else did he turn up with?
A load of beer. Yeah.
Did you crack one open with him?
We did, yes. Yeah. A beer called Westfalia, and you can't buy it. You have to be on a list to buy it.
Yeah.
So, yeah. But by then, he's no longer the man he was. You know, in those years when I was turning pro and racing behind him, he was just an animal. Massive, massive legs. I can remember one leg being bigger than the other. Yeah. He used to sit far back in the saddle and heels in the frame and massive gear. And when you turn pro and you ride behind someone like that, you can't ever imagine being that good and looking like that. You think you just look... I don't know, it's an incredible thing to explain. But now I meet him now, and he's not like he used to be, tall because he's funny and that. And you let your guard down when you finish cycling. You're no longer this guarded person that you perceive. You have to put a perception on. So as a competitor and all this, it's strange, you know, kind of... Years later, you meet people, then you think, God, actually, you're really nice guy. Eric Zabel's the same now. He's the most chatty man in
definitely.
And that's what sport does to people, you know?
Was he the guy you were seriously in awe of? Was there anyone else that you've got stories about?
Like, from a Grand Tour point of view, but you can't... I was watching Indra in those days. I can never imagine... That's a different world, you know? You can never imagine doing what he do. But there was always something that I thought, well, no, I could do the classics, and for one day I could maybe finish Paris-Roubaix and come onto that velodrome. But just on Roubaix, I think I'll ask Maggie, because it's probably one of the most unique sprints. So you go through all those crazy cobbles, you go through all this, you get there, punches it, and then you come onto this velodrome with a lap and a half to go of a sprint that is probably, as I said, the most unique. You've got a banking you can use for speed. You can stay low. It's not track things, so you can come on the blue.
Yeah, well...
I mean, it's just this... It is the strangest sprint. And whether you've ridden the track on or not, but to come onto there, and you can hear a bell on the other side of the track because someone else has just come on, and you don't know who's on what lap and behind, and it's a strange one. I mean, you've won a sprint from that position, so you can probably tell what it's like.
It is really quite weird, and it's one of the things that... Like, the first time I raced, I came onto that velodrome, and we were sprinting for fourth place. I was leading Fred Moncassin out there, the old French sprinter there, and it was really quite strange because muddy tyres on the banked velodrome, and you kind of were freaking out a little bit, is this going to be enough grip for me to go up the track or not, and you're sprinting as if it was a track race. And I took a mental note of that day in 98 of how I moved around on the track and the fact that I used it as a track race, and went back and kind of looked at all of the sprints that had been done on the velodrome in a bigger group and how the people moved, and then obviously looked in the rule books, and it's a road race, so you're allowed to go on the inside, you're allowed to use effectively the gravel on the inside, as long as you come across the finish line you're fine and doing whatever. So subconsciously I'd worked into my head that was a possibility, and quite a big one at that, and as Roger Hammond boxed me in on the back straight, it's sort of I never even tried backing out and around and trying to go around Tristan Hoffmann and Roger and Cancellara. I was just waiting for Cancellara to move up the track a fraction and managed to go down the inside of him, and that was the winning move at the end.
Yeah.
You know, and
so it's such a unique sprint. You just don't get anything like it. You know, it's not like a track race in some respects.
And who are you looking at this year? I mean, it's impossible to call, but who do we foresee being in the mix at the end? And are we hoping for a wet race or a dry race? Because if it's wet, it's going to be, you know, slipping and sliding everywhere.
I think I'm going to do the rain dance, actually, and I'm hoping for a wet Paris-Bay. It hasn't been one for yonks.
The last one was 2004 slightly wet, wasn't it? 2005, I remember there was...
We had a couple of sort of damp sections. But it was probably wet.
Musée, wasn't it?
2002, Sebastian. Knarvan.
No, that was one.
And one, yeah.
Two was Museo Boone, and remember when Boone got third?
Yeah.
They were the last years, weren't
they? Those were the last years, yeah. Because remember the first time that we used the cobbles in Ovrebay in the Tour when Nibali was up there in the wet?
Yes.
Cancellara put a tweet out the night before saying, anyone out there know how to ride these things in the wet? And that kind of got me a little bit, the fact that he'd never, throughout his whole career, never ridden Paris-Bay in the wet.
Yeah.
And it's the most awesome bike race in the world when it's wet. It's
awesome,
it's
more spectacle.
It's more carnage than it normally is in the dry.
Yeah.
And
when it's dry, how do you feel afterwards? Because you've basically spent
coughing
half
up
a day
dust.
Sucking up dust.
Yeah. You're coughing dust for about a week, aren't you?
It's the Monday morning when you start get back on your bike, if you do or whatever, and you start cleaning your shoes again, and you know you kind of realise all the mud that's got, just dust really, more than mud.
Mm.
Your glasses, your helmet, everything's just caked in dust, because you just don't realise after the finish. You know, you're kind of so walking in a daze around those showers, and the stories, people coming in the bus, have you finished? Or someone will come in with a broken arm, and everyone's talking and kind of seeing how they got on in the day, and you've got out the shower and a big group finish, and three of your guys have finished half an hour down just because they want to finish Paris-Roubaix.
Just to say you've done
just
it.
Just to say you've got to the velodrome.
Yeah,
it's phenomenal. I think there's more.
It's the only race you'll do that, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, I think so.
Everywhere else, you're just going to quite happily climb
pretty
off.
Pretty much.
Don't worry about it.
And the time gaps as well, by the time you sort of get the first group of riders gone through and the first bunch, is almost mountain stage Tour de France kind of time gaps to open up. You know, the last guy, like you said, coming down, you know, 50-odd minutes down on the winner, but he's managed to get himself across all the fields and dodge all the Belgian drunk spectators and all the rest of it as the race is kind of long gone through, but he's out there on his own wanting to finish. And that to me is part of what Paris-Roubaix is that this sort of heritage of the sport, the history of the race, the roads that we do go across on, and the history that they carry is what makes that race so special. And there's only one day a year that you could do 100 bike races and they're more or less the same. Mm. Even if we're taking the Tour of Flanders, Het Nieuwsblad, E3, Waregem, Kern, Brussels, Kern, there's a good 10-15 bike races in Belgium that more or less look the same, but there's only one day on the year that looks like Paris-Roubaix does.
Talking about that sort of camaraderie in the bus afterwards, you know, especially with a race like Roubaix, is that one of the things you miss the most, having retired from the professional peloton? Let me ask you, having retired from professional road cycling, what is it you miss the most? And what, if anything, have you taken up in its place to fill that void?
Well, I miss the adrenaline rush of being in the hot air. You know, the type of racing that I did was the classics and lead out for the sprints and all that sort of stuff. And the adrenaline rush that you get from doing stuff like that and going in with that kind of a commitment and camaraderie that sort of develops as well, the trust between you and your teammates and the sort of will to deliver and making sure that you're giving that 100%. I think that's been difficult, I think, to fill that void with, you know. And I ended up doing a bit of Ironman and stuff like that. But it was just for me, it was a thing I wanted to. I've always wanted to do some Ironmans. I always, you know, really respected those athletes for what they do, because it's a pretty grueling kind of sport.
Well, and then, road cycling clearly wasn't difficult enough for you.
Well, so you know, if you're gonna have a go at something, make it difficult, right? But no, it's sort of filled the gap for me for a couple of years, and I really enjoyed doing it. But I think it'll always be difficult to fill that space with your mates on the team bus after a race when you're really nailed everything.
Brad, What about you? You know, we've spoken before about how you felt institutionalised almost, yeah. and it was in many ways maybe a relief to have been out of certainly that Team Sky bubble and not have those same commitments that you did. But did you get to a point where you found like having given up, obviously with your own team, given up riding, did you get to a point where you found like you wanted something else?
Yeah, I just had enough of cycling, really. I'd had enough of it. I'd had enough of the fame it brought me and all that sort of stuff. I craved normality and I craved a bit of solitude, really. But I wanted to still train because it was the only thing I knew. So routine, structure, and just I was institutionalised to train and the endorphins it gave you when you finish a session. I started rowing on an indoor row machine and then it kind of advanced to getting on water, which was just as kind of a lot of escapism and that. And just a change of identity. I got sick of being Sir Bradley Wiggins and kind of hero-worshipped and all this. For 20 years, I'd just been called a hero and a legend, you know, and other things, obviously, but only behind your back. But that's the problem.
That's
the problem you see. You only hear it behind your back or by someone called, never by a real person. Go, do you know what? I actually really like you, but I think you can be a bit of a d*** at times. Or something like, people don't tell you that in this.
Sure.
In this, so they only heap praise on you. And that creates a lot of problems for you long term, really. Until you, if you don't get out of that and have a good family around you and stuff like that, you just walk around for the rest of your life entitled, thinking people should know who you are, thinking that that status gets you in restaurants or you get freebies, this, that, and enough. And you've got to come out of that pretty quickly, leave it all behind and move on for the sake of... Otherwise, your kids grow up idiots as well, you know? It's just things like that. It's not real, you know? And I just think... But after 2 years now, I've kind of realised I don't have to do that. You can let it go. You don't have to train every day. You don't have to be a, you know, superstar, amazing athlete. You can do anything, you know, because that's all people ever tell you as well. You know, you're capable of anything. And you feel like you have to put a front up and hold that front up, you know. And now it's like, no, you can just be normal. Leave it. It's all right. Just be a good parent.
Well, you don't have to be that super lean, super fit athlete that you were. You can quite happily walk around and ride your bike still just because you enjoy doing it, going out with your son, daughters, whatever. And I think last year was one of the coolest days for me, because
I think for people around us taking pictures it was, but we were unawares of what was happening.
So we went out to the mini Paris-Roubaix with our kids. So I had my youngest daughter riding, Brad had his son riding, and we were stood at the start line there. And
Maggie was fixing my son's bike at the start, and I was holding the screwdriver while he was
demoted to mechanic. And
so, well, we're both mechanics and just dads out.
And then both stood on the end of the car four waiting for all these kids to come through.
Yeah.
It was amazing to see all these kids. So, you know, as we've been speaking about today, we're still there now after Maggie's been 15 years on the same stretch of road where he was talking about coming off and seeing there was five left. And you're doing it, you know, you're still... So this sport keeps you in it, and it's... And we talk about, how do you detach? Well, there's your kids now. You're doing it for them as well.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
It's rowing a real, as you say, a detachment for you, a proper, like, back to basics.
Because it was brutal as well.
Yeah.
And it was quantifiable because it's numbers. You do this number, you do, you know. I like that as well.
At what point did you come round to thinking of, hold on a second, my numbers have got to a certain level here that if I continue to go on this trajectory, I can start looking at...
Well, I was never going to continue to go on the trajectory because they're getting faster. While you're getting faster in the short time you've had, they're getting just as fast. And you've still got to transfer it to a boat, which is a whole other ball game. It's like sitting on an indoor machine and producing the numbers you need to produce to do a team pursuit, but then do it on the track with the turns and the changes and everything else. I was never going to get that.
So 2020.
That's 20 years of work. That
2020 was never the Olympics. That was never. That was us all getting excited in the media.
Well, I think you see, and this is. I never actually said that. I don't think I ever came out in an interview and said I want to try and make the Olympic team. Someone asked me, and where do you think this is going to go? And I said, well, I'll be lying if I didn't think halfway through these 2 hour hour and a half ergo machine things that there's a sixth Olympic gold in there somewhere. That's what I said. But that's the silly things you find in those periods to get you through those things, you know?
Yeah.
But once it came out, I was like, well, it gives me something to... But then that's what I mean. I'm holding on to this thing because they're still talking about me in the press.
Sure.
Going to the Olympics. So you sort of somehow convince yourself that you're doing this. But then
one feeds the other.
Yeah. You got to let it go. Got to let it go.
So you're still rowing?
Because then the point came. No. But the point came then. It was like, right, it's 2 years to go to the Olympics. I'm going to have to go and move back down south now, back away from the family. The reason I've just stopped cycling to go.
Get back into that whole
and then
cycle.
You're like, well, hang on a minute. How's this happened again? You know, you've tired once and then it just catches up with you. Then you hit the drink and then it starts, you know. You found an addiction. No.
None of that.
That's it, you know. So, yeah.
Never fancy a crack at Ironman? How's your swimming?
No, I have to be careful now that whatever I go into, that I don't reignite my old...
There's no Olympics, though.
No, I just don't want to become that person again.
Yeah.
That's just, I get so obsessive with stuff. I've got an obsessive
I've got to ask you this question, all right? So whenever I get back on a bike, so I go away with my daughters now for a training camp, and I sort of, you know, legs aren't quite working to start off with, and about 5-6 days into the camp, you start getting your legs back in again, and you're thinking, oh, hang on a minute, I'm actually going all right here. Before you know it, or certainly before I know it, I've worked out what I need to do to be at a certain level again within a certain period of time. Do you find the same thing when if you're going out, if you start getting back into a sport, that you've very quickly worked out?
Well, I started
out
running a bit, actually, and I started looking at, you start trying to, okay, well, if I ran at this pace for a marathon, what time would that give me?
Yeah,
and then you start trying to work out, well, what's it take to do a sub 3-hour marathon? And
exactly.
And before you know it, you've started running away with, you know.
I'm happy it's not just me.
So, Brad, to do the marathon at the 2020 Tokyo Olympics. So.
Leave me alone. Come on. I'm a successful Olympian. Leave me. Let me be that till Jason Kenny gets you next year.
Yeah. Well, that's about it for this episode of the Bradley Wiggins Show by Eurosport. We'll be back next Monday. Until then, you can stay up to date with all things Brad on Brad's social media channels. Brad at
Sir Wiggo.
Sir Wiggo. Maggie, we can keep up to date with what's going on with you at
@Maggie_PR.
Thank you very much. And you can follow Eurosport on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. And if you've enjoyed the show, please do subscribe, share and rate on iTunes. But for now, from me, Graham Wilgos, from Brad and from Magnus, chaps, it's goodbye. Thanks for joining
us. Goodbye. Thank you.
Thank you.
We'll see you next week.
The Bradley Wiggins Show is a Muddy Knees Media production for Eurosport.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.